When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight I'm looking at the development of the mandate system at the Paris Peace Conference as a result of the Wilsonian 14 points, the mandate that Woodrow Wilson created for his vision of a post-war world. The reason why I want to look at the development of mandates, which were the former German and Ottoman colonies, which were then meant to be held in trust by the new League of Nations until they were sufficiently developed to rule themselves. The reason why I want to look at these is because very often the League of Nations and the Paris Peace Conference are taught really within the kind of the context of the development of Weimar and then Nazi Germany, the impact of the Paris Peace Conference and the Treaty of Versailles on Weimar Germany, and its the appeal of Hitler as a result of these things. So we really lose sight of the enormous world-altering significance of the mandates. If you imagine that three of the mandates, Palestine, Syria and Iraq, Palestine now largely occupied by Israel, have are the three of the kind of the most fundamental and important turbulent zones of conflict in our world at the moment. Much of this is explained by the way in which these states were enabled to emerge from their respective mandates. And also, it tells us an enormous amount about the struggle for Anglo-French colonialism to sustain itself after the First World War and to defend itself against the anti-colonial pressures coming from America. From the point of view of the US, Adam Tooze, I think, makes this point very, very clearly, that he doesn't see the 14 points as a kind of a liberal blueprint for the future governance of the world at all. He sees this as a document of American power. The 14 points, as far as Tooze is concerned, was a device to supplant European colonial power with the power of kind of American trade, which America would have an overwhelming comparative advantage in in the post-war years, having eclipsed Britain as the dominant economy in the world. So today we're going to look again at The Guardians by Susan Peterson, and we are jumping into the arrival of Woodrow Wilson in Europe. And she writes, "On the USS George Washington in the icy mid-Atlantic in December 1918, George Louis Beer felt the weight of the world on his shoulders. Beer, a 46-year-old former businessman and lecturer in British history at Columbia University, was part of the 100-man delegation accompanying Woodrow Wilson on his mission to bring to Europe a just and lasting peace. Beer had been the colonial policy expert on The Inquiry, that wartime cabal of American academics assembled to plan the settlement. His particular responsibility was to secure the free and open-minded and absolutely impartial adjustment of all colonial claims, promised in the fifth of Wilson's 14 points. Annexation of the conquered German and Ottoman territories had been ruled out of the question, and through 1918, proposals had emerged to place backward or derelict peoples under international control. But it was still far from clear what the international system might look like." So here we have the refusal by Wilson to allow European empires to expand, French and British empires to expand. But the idea of there being backward and derelict peoples, unfit for self-rule, inherently kind of colonial thinking in its own right. Margaret Macmillan, in her book The Peacemakers, writes that Wilson had large numbers of very, very gifted and intelligent people on board the USS George Washington, and yet engaged with none of them. Wilson sort of essentially shuts himself away in his stateroom, and no one could talk to him. Those that do get to talk to him, when Beer eventually does get to talk to him, they find he's very, very vague and sort of speaks in broad principles, not in specifics. He hoped that the Germany's colonies might be handed, might become the property of the League of Nations and be administered by a smaller non-imperial state, perhaps one of the Scandinavian countries. But Sir Bravoli agreed that there was no way Germany could have their colonies back. Nothing could be more ignoble than to turn over millions of helpless natives to the tender mercies of Germany. Neither men believed that Africans were capable of any form of self-government, both deeply tainted by America's own racial discrimination. Beer wrote, "The Negro race has hitherto shown no capacity for progressive development except under the tutelage of other peoples." And he thought that this tutelage would have to be internationalised. You couldn't allow the British to just do it, or the French. It couldn't be direct colonial rule anymore, and would have to be open to some kind of public scrutiny, which really had this kind of emerged in the way that Beer was talking about, would have been a liberal colonialism, if you will. He believed that there should be humane and progressive norms, but that ultimately self-rule was out of the question. Beer didn't think that the small nations of Europe were capable of doing this. What could, for example, Norway offer? Beer had all sorts of ideas about there being, indeed, taxonomies of Europeans. That there were relative, different European nations and nationalities had relatively different kind of values. And, for example, he was shocked to see Germans and Magyars and Italians being sacrificed to people whose cultural value was infinitely less. And he thought it far preferable to have Poles under German and Yugoslavs under Italians rule than the contrary. His ideas of when it came to governing colonies, he thought that one nation
had provided the model for the rest of the world to follow. And of course, by this, he meant Great Britain. He wrote as a scholar of British history, and this perhaps indicates why Britain manages to do so well when it comes to the question of mandates, better than they had expected. Native rights were the most carefully and effectively protected in British colonies, he wrote. He also thought that Britain was the power most committed to those free trading economic policies that the US also endorsed. So Britain might be quite helpful junior partner managing colonies around the world in Beer's thinking. And also, if Britain was committed to free trade, they could make sure those colonies were open to American goods. And perhaps, if nothing else, even if Britain didn't become directly involved, then the League of Nations could model Britain's example and run things in basically the same way. British politicians and internationalists and humanitarians were very keen on this idea and saw opportunities for Britain to be the power that was delegated to run mandates on the part of the League of Nations. Susan Peterson writes, "By the time Wilson sailed, the British were, metaphorically speaking, in the mid-Atlantic, ready to greet him. The continental settlement reached at Versailles, heavily shaped by French interests and anxieties, would seek above all to contain Germany. The colonial settlement, however, was an Anglo-American product. It looked the way it did because the British were so desperate for an American alliance, but also because American preferences and ideals could be reconciled most easily with British imperial practices. But if the affinity between American and British interests structured the mandate system from the start, it also left the system more vulnerable when the Americans pulled out. By late 1919, the French were openly seeking to subvert an international regime that they perceived, rightly, to be structured against them. The mandates regime that was born at the Paris Peace Conference was nearly dead by 1920. Most European states, both victors and vanquished, had little belief that anything particularly high-minded was occurring as a result of the Paris Peace Conference. There had been two centuries of great power colonial exchange, of the great powers of Europe swapping colonies, islands, and interests around the world as a result of warfare. And it was generally believed that had Germany won the war, Germany would have extracted immense colonial concessions from the vanquished powers. So while German armies were fighting in Belgium, Dominion armies were moving into Germany's colonial possessions. Germany's Samoan Islands were surrendered to a landing party of New Zealand troops on the 29th of August 1914. The phosphate island of Nauru, for example, was turned over to the HMAS Melbourne on the 9th of September, and some 3 weeks later, after a short fight, the capital of Germany's holdings in New Guinea in the Bismarck Archipelago fell to the Australian naval force. The Australians also pressed forward to the equator, only to discover that the Japanese had already sent warships to capture the Caroline, Mariana and Marshall Islands. By mid-October, all Germany's Pacific possessions were in Allied hands.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Germany and Britain fought a long and catastrophic war in Africa. There is an excellent book on this called Tip and Run, which shows around the African Great Lakes the unbelievable devastation done and the loss of life to African soldiers and colonial troops alike, far greater on the part of African soldiers. Susan Peterson writes, "Ousting Germany from Africa took longer. British and French troops swiftly occupied Togoland and the Cameroonian port of Douala, but the well-equipped German forces in the interior resisted. Not until early 1916 would they pass into Spanish territory. The Southwest African campaign ran into trouble too, for some troops mutinied rather than take up arms against fellow whites. Only in spring 1915 was a new invasion mounted and Windhoek taken." The campaign for German East Africa proved most troublesome of all. For 4 years, the clever German general Paul von Lettow-Vorbeck and his capable African askaris tied up British and South African forces in a guerrilla campaign waged throughout East Africa. That campaign and the opportunistic seizure of Rwanda and Burundi by a rapacious Belgian force left famine and devastation in its wake, as the colonial wars in Africa were wont to do. It's interesting to observe terms of examining, in critical terms, colonial practices, what happens next. Very quickly, the occupying powers, far from being liberators, begin to operate directly in colonial manner. South Africa extended its rail line north and began handing out land to white settlers. Australia doubled the number of New Guinean indentured labourers on seized copra plantations. By 1916, when the British government first appointed an interdepartmental committee to think through policy towards the captured territories, annexationist sentiment was strong. Although the representative from the General Staff warned that the balance of power required a strong Teutonic state in Central Europe and that Germany would become resentful and hard to manage if not accorded a colonial sphere, his objections were swiftly quashed. Whether to amplify imperial holdings, as with Germany and East Africa, to provide booty and buffers for the dominions, as with the Pacific territories and Southwest Africa, or simply as bribes for importunate allies, the plan for Togo and Cameroon, the German colonies should all be retained, a decision confirmed by the War Cabinet Committee on Territorial Desiderata in the spring of 1917. So the British Empire, and the French as well, continued to function as they always had done, and there was no reason to imagine that they would function in any other way. They certainly weren't going to give Germany its colonies back, even if certain people in the Foreign Office thought this was a good idea to prevent the possibility of a kind of revanchist Germany. In reality, when revanchism emerged in the guise of Hitler, Hitler was not really very interested in Pacific colonies or parts of Africa. Hitler took the view that Germany's colonial future lay in Russia, and that Lebensraum would be gained by extending all the way up to the River Volga. The term that was used in the Foreign Office was "what we have, we hold." French society was, of course, mainly focused on the carnage and destruction wrought on French soil, and the desire for revenge. In 1917, the future of German colonies was decided by a series of officials and lobbyists, and who would meet with Belgian colonial officials, and they recognised that the control of Germany's colonies in Africa would be easy were it not for the British who have a rather irritating habit of devising international agreements and treaties that would bind France's hands to do what France wished in Africa, and perhaps to fully annex colonies, former German colonies, directly into the French Empire. None of this kind of mandate business. And the fact that the British were quite close to the Americans, and the Americans are, if anything, even more wary of France's empire than they are of the British. Of course, German colonies aren't the only prize, and in many ways, the division of the Ottoman Empire, which was something that Lloyd George was very, very keen on and saw as a chief war aim, unlike most of the rest of the war cabinet, was something that the British and the French had been colluding on since 1915. So Susan Peterson writes, "The Allies were also dismembering and squabbling over the Ottoman Empire. The secret Treaty of London of April 1915 brought Italy into the war with a promise of parts of southern Anatolia as well as equitable compensation in Africa, while leaving the Middle Eastern provinces to Britain and France. All powers, however, found it hard to make good on these plans. Britain's Indian Army had attacked Mesopotamia early in the war, only to find itself mired in a draining campaign that would last 4 years and cost over 90,000, mostly Indian casualties. New surrogates were needed, and in 1915 one was found in Sharif Hussein, ruler of the Hejaz, restive under the Ottoman overlordship and willing to lend Britain in aid in exchange for recognition of his own sovereign claims." So here we get into some very complicated stuff. Sharif Hussein of Mecca, at the same time that Britain and France are promising one another the division of Mesopotamia, Syria and Palestine, Sharif Hussein is offered all of Arabia, everything from the tip of the Arabian Peninsula all the way up to the borders of Turkey. So all everything, including Palestine, Syria, what becomes Jordan, and Iraq. And the British essentially lie to him through this thing, these letters, the McMahon correspondence, with Sir Henry McMahon, who was the British High Commissioner in Egypt. And here we see the story of T.E. Lawrence and Lawrence of Arabia. What results is, of course, the Arab Revolt, and the British and French bicker with one another constantly throughout this time. The British had no intention of allowing Syria to fall into French hands, and at the end of the First World War, the British allow and even encourage the Arabs to seize Damascus. The reason why they do this is because they believe that the Arabs, led by Sharif Hussein, were, if they manage to conquer Syria and seize it from the Ottomans before the French get there, that they will be sort of useful dupes that the British can rule. The British would be able to say to the French, "Listen, the Arabs have liberated themselves. You have no right to go there as their colonial masters. unfortunately, sorry chaps, you didn't get there first. And the French knew this was exactly the game the British were playing. And in a way, Britain's games here and Britain's attempts to stop the French from claiming the colony that they believed that was rightly theirs. The French had all sorts of romantic associations with Syria. Was a part of what initiated the immense violence against Syrian nationalists that the French suspected and feared after France is actually given Syria as a League of Nations mandate, which they essentially view as a colony and proceed to rule it as thus. Susan Peterson writes, in France, Robert de Caille, an aristocratic Catholic secretary of the powerful and well-connected Comité de l'Asie Française, noted the Anglo-Arab alliance with trepidation. France had powerful interests in the Levant. By 1914, France had guaranteed the autonomy of the Christian community of Mount Lebanon for half a century. French companies handled much of the silk trade. France had become the lingua franca for the educated class, and there were 40,000 children enrolled in French schools. Now, De Caille's imperial lobby hoped to bring the whole of Syria, and if possible, Palestine too, under France's wing. But France had no troops to spare for Middle Eastern adventures and had used diplomacy to stake its claims. This is essentially true. The British do the bulk of the fighting in the Middle East, other than France's involvement in the Dardanelles campaign. So being able to claim colonial territories in the former Ottoman Empire is quite difficult. And the British eventually, in 1916, long before their decision to aid the Arabs into Damascus, provisionally agree in the Sykes-Picot Agreement to allow the French to control Syria in return for British control of Mesopotamia, which the British believed in oil terms was much, much more valuable. So we'll pause there, and I think we'll continue to look at mandates over the next few months or so, because it's very, very important story as the kind of the long shadow of colonialism and imperialism that was cast over the 20th century and into the 21st perpetuates. If you check out the explaininghistory.org this week, there's a few things on the blog that you might find interesting, a couple of little extensions to some of the podcasts we've done recently, and a little bit of video. And you can always find us at Patreon if you want to check us out and sponsor us. There's some exclusive content going on Patreon at the moment about the schism within American conservatism that has brought us so much insanity of late. Thanks very much. All the best, and I'll catch you soon. Bye-bye.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.